Could the current and ongoing billboard campaign being promoted by architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth represent the breakthrough that 9/11 activists have been waiting 12 long years to achieve? Could the presentations at Ottawa City Hall in Canada be the key to getting a Canadian investigation of the attacks? Is there any realistic vehicle for dealing with the unanswered questions of 9/11? What are the forces undermining truth movements from the Kennedy assassination to 9/11 to the Fukushima disaster? On today's program, we hear radically different perspectives from Ottawa-based 9/11 activist David Long and from two legendary 9/11 activists, architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth founder Richard Gage and investigative journalist, broadcaster, and author Michael Rupert. On today's program, on the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy murder, we ask the question, has 9/11 Truth gone the way of JFK Truth? Bringing you the analysis beyond the headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 29th, 2013. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM out of Winnipeg. We seek to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major stories shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website at globalresearch.ca. Our show is also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Two weeks after the Fukushima accident, we reported that the government responded to the nuclear accident by trying to raise acceptable radiation levels and pretending that radiation is good for us. We noted earlier this month, Japan will likely pass a new anti-whistleblowing law in an attempt to silence criticism of TEPCO and the government. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe's government is planning a state secrets act that critics say could curtail public access to information on a wide range of issues, including tensions with China and the Fukushima nuclear crisis. The new law would dramatically expand the definition of official secrets, and journalists convicted under it could be jailed for up to 5 years. Earlier this year, the acting EPA director signed a revised version of the EPA's Protective Action Guide for Radiological Incidents, which radically relaxing the safety guidelines agencies follow in the wake of a nuclear reactor meltdown or other unexpected release of radiation. EPA whistleblowers called it, quote, a public health policy only Dr. Strangelove could embrace, unquote. That's from the article, Japan Reacts to Fukushima Crisis by Banning Journalism, by Washington's blog, posted November 27th, originally appearing on Washington's blog. It has been a frustrating couple of weeks watching, listening, and otherwise searching in vain for any balanced media coverage within the many JFK retrospectives that have been offered up on TV, radio, and newspapers about the 50th anniversary of the assassination of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. The JFK assassination experts, scholars, researchers, critical thinkers, and assorted patriots who hate tyranny and who want to have all the facts fairly presented have been consistently dismissed as conspiracy theorists, even though the evidence that they were not allowed to present would prove the existence of a conspiracy. For example, JFK's brain and or parts of his skull were exploded backwards out of a large exit wound in the back of the skull onto the trunk of the presidential limo, which is the reason why Jackie was famously seen on film footage turning around and reaching backwards. The Secret Service agent Clint Hill consistently testified that Jackie was not reaching for him, but for fragments of JFK's brain, which she was retrieving in the vain hope that it could be somehow used by doctors to save her husband's life. The testimony of the involved physicians and other witnesses at Parkland Hospital confirms that there was an entry wound in the right front of JFK's head and a blowout wound in the back of the head. That's from the article Disputing the Official Theory that Oswald was the Lone Assassin of JFK. More evidence from Global Research News, posted November 27th. Since Aristide's government was overthrown in February 2004, Haiti Progrès and Haiti Liberté newspapers have described Canada as an occupying force, coup supporter, or imperialist at least 100 times. Haiti's left-wing weeklies have detailed Ottawa's role in planning the coup, destabilizing the elected government, building a repressive Haitian police force, justifying politically motivated arrests and killings, militarizing post-earthquake disaster relief, pushing the exclusion of Haiti's most popular party, FANMI-LAVALAS, from participating in elections. While the above-mentioned information has been copiously detailed in Haitian newspapers, as well as English-language books, reports, and left media, Canada's dominant media rarely critically discusses this country's role in Haiti. On February 28, 2014, tens of thousands are likely to hit the streets across Haiti to once again express their rejection of the U.S.-France-Canada coup. Is any major news agency in this country prepared to mark the occasion by telling Canadians what their government has done over the past decade to undermine Haitian sovereignty and democracy? That's from the article, The Real Story About Canada's Role in Haiti, by Eve Engler, posted November 27th, originally appearing at eveengler.com. Having failed with the public and with those who grow our food, one could understand that GM companies feel the need to lobby UK politicians in order to further their desire to control our food supply. But in the United States, where much of the food is now so GM-based that it is difficult to avoid eating it, you would think they had won the battle for American hearts and intestines. Last April, U.S. citizens were outraged by the passing of what became known as the Monsanto Protection Act. A rider, H.R. 933, quietly added to the Agriculture Appropriations Bill, which says federal courts cannot intervene and halt biotech companies from planting and selling GMO goods to the public, even if testing proves them to be potentially hazardous to the greater public. According to Russia Today, quote, Senator Roy Blunt, Republican from Missouri, has been credited with crafting the language of H.R. 933 by working directly alongside Monsanto. Blunt has received $64,250 from Monsanto towards his campaign committee between 2008 and 2012. That's from the article Genetically Modified Politicians, Their Battle to Persuade the Public to Accept GM Food, by Leslie Doxey, posted November 27th, originally published at theecologist.org. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. So over the last 2 months, there's been a lot of activism around 9/11 and bringing awareness to Americans and to Canadians as well. And there's been something of a stir happening in Ottawa, the city of Ottawa in particular. I'm joined on the line by somebody who has not only been very much at the spearheading a lot of these efforts, but is himself a survivor of the 9/11 attacks. His name is David Long, joining us from Ottawa. Hello, David. How are you today?
Michael, I'm good. Nice to talk with you.
Okay. Do you want to just maybe fill in a little bit, just briefly, I mean, how you came to be so involved in the whole issue of 9/11 activism? I mean, you survived it, but what propelled you forward to go beyond that?
Well, from the moment of 9/11, I mean, I was almost killed during 9/11, so, you know, you take that sort of thing personally. But from the moment it happened, I had doubts about the official story. There were multiple explosions. I could see molten metal. I was one of the first people that ever saw the molten metal coming out of the towers and many other things. And I knew, like many, many New Yorkers, that there was a lot of things that were very wrong about what we were told about 9/11 on that day. And those doubts only grew. And I never really came to have anybody explain it to me in any way that made sense until architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth were introduced to me in around 2008. And from that point on, they asked me to volunteer. I was very flattered. So I started working for them, and it's grown now into 9/11 Justice Canada, which is a driving force behind the truth movement. And I don't think I'm going too far to say that Canada is one of the leading 9/11 truth countries outside of the United States now.
Okay. Now, you in the month of September, there was some public furor about ads that were on buses that basically asked people to reflect on the fact that, did you know that a third tower fell on September 11th? And some folks in the community got upset, and as a result, there's been some talk about revisiting the advertising policies on these buses. And so basically, in a nutshell, you ended up at Ottawa City Hall essentially defending these ads. Do I have that just about right?
Well, I would change a couple of things you said. It wasn't some. It was actually one person that complained, a student at Carleton University. And the city councilor responded and said some things about the ad campaign being insensitive to 9/11 victims. I don't think she knew that there was one actually living in the city, and I certainly didn't agree with her viewpoint. And so the people who were actually defending themselves were the city council, and to be more specific, Diane Deans. The majority of the people from the beginning of the ads, actually, a News 1310 poll, something like 93% of the people in Ottawa supported the ad campaign. So it was actually a case of the many versus the few, and the few were actually Diane Deans and one student who objected to the ads. The majority of us in Ottawa, that's hundreds of thousands of people, supported the ad campaign. So the meeting with the people at the transit committee was an incredible meeting. We had done our research, and we knew that the Supreme Court already supported our position. So there was nothing that the Transit Commission could actually do, because the law that protects freedom of speech in Canada protected us also. So they weren't expecting that they would have also a 9/11 survivor address them to say that, in fact, they were wrong, that hundreds of victims' families actually supported the Rethink campaign, and Diane Deans was completely out of place and entirely incorrect in what she had said. Mm-hmm. So they had no questions for me, not surprisingly. And then Isabel Beenan, the spokesperson for AE 9/11 Truth, gave their statement. And at that time, one of the most unprecedented 9/11 truth actions ever occurred, where 12 times we played the video of Tower 7 collapsing. And there's nothing more powerful than video for getting a message across. And the entire transit committee, there were 17 commissioners there. They all watched Tower 7 collapse in 6.5 seconds 12 times. And it was an incredible presentation. You could hear a pin drop in the room. So what we've seen is a debate about the 9/11 evidence held by public officials in office with the 9/11 evidence shown by video, and a clear public win for the 9/11 truth movement. So all politicians out there who were ever thinking that they ought to say something about 9/11 but were worried about the political side effects, it is clear now from what has happened is that it's clear now that, that politicians can talk about 9/11. And there was a lawyer who actually cited Stuart Mill spoke favorably about the ads in the context of the law. So What the hearings showed is that you can debate 9/11, you can come on side with 9/11 truth, and you can do it with the majority of the public supporting you. So this is an example for politicians now to see And they should be moving on this, because looking at the polls, we are actually in the majority. We are legally in the right, and the trends are increasing. So it's a great time to be in the truth movement, and it's actually now imperative that politicians get on the right side of this issue.
The next activist step for you is?
We're going to do it again. This was the, like, at the hearings, we made a political maneuver of our own, and we said we're not just saying that we're right, we're actually going to announce that we're doing more ads in Ottawa at the hearings. And so they'll be running again in December, and as a political message, this is saying not only are we right, but you can't stop us, and we're going to do it again. So this proves publicly now that we have the upper hand, we are right, and we're expanding. And this movement is moving forward. It's had the most incredible effect in Canada ever. From Newfoundland to Prince George, there are 20 cities now that are going to be having Richard Gage speak next year. This is all heading towards the election in 2015. And we are going to be making a huge political statement in the next election. So there's a two-year plan here, all aimed around the federal election. And all the momentum is growing, and it's on our side. So this is an amazing time for to be a truther in Canada.
Okay. Well, David Long, I want to thank you very much for sharing that that story with us. And I guess good luck on your campaign.
Thank you. We'll be talking.
Okay. Thanks, David. The group Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth launched its billboard and postering campaign in the month of September. The expensive effort drew attention to the third tower, World Trade Center 7, which mysteriously collapsed on the afternoon of September 11, 2001, mere hours after the more famous collapses of the Twin Towers that morning. The question therefore arises, can the Rethink 9/11 campaign ultimately result in a new investigation or anything that will significantly alter public discourse on this topic? Joining us to discuss this, we have one of the organizers of Rethink 9/11. His name is Richard Gage. And Richard Gage, AIA, is a San Francisco Bay Area architect and member of the American Institute of Architects, founding member of Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth. And he's joining us from San Francisco. Hello, Richard Gage.
Hi, Michael.
First of all, let's talk about the Rethink 9/11 campaign. Now, the focus is on World Trade Center 7. I'm just wondering, like, of the many different areas of evidence with regard to the problems with the official story of 9/11, why World Trade Center 7 is the one that you seem to be harping on?
World Trade Center 7 wakes people up to the reality that we have controlled demolition at the World Trade Center towers. When people become aware of the obvious nature of the destruction of this tower, they are then open to becoming aware of the very explosive demolition, the shattering of the structures of the Twin Towers. So then when we show them the towers, show them how a 4-ton perimeter wall units were ejected laterally at 60 miles an hour, landing 600 feet in every direction. When we show them the pools of molten iron under the basements of the Twin Towers and at the base of the piles in World Trade Center 7, it all begins to tie together into opening a series of very important questions. If these buildings were all destroyed with controlled demolition, Building 7 being the most obvious, then we have to grapple with the implications of those controlled demolitions, which is, of course, who could have had access to these buildings to plant these explosives and engineer this destruction? Who could have had been responsible? How did they get away with it? What about the planes? What about the hijackers? There's a whole series of questions that follow in the footsteps of the realization of these controlled demolitions. So the 2,000 architects and engineers that I represent who are calling for a real investigation of all three of these demolitions are deeply concerned about the remaining questions as well.
Is there a consensus of opinion as to who was responsible?
It's pretty clear that whoever was responsible for the perpetration of this crime of mass murder, treason, and any number of other crimes had to have had access to the highest security levels in these buildings. After all, these were terrorist targets. You don't just walk in these buildings and set demolitions in them. These people would have had to have compromised the security. They would have had to have had an operation in place where they could have set these explosives, such as, for instance, an elevator modernization, such as the one that Ace Elevator had the 9 months prior to 9/11 in the Twin Towers, which was very well documented. The perpetrators would have had to have access to extremely sophisticated nanothermite incendiaries and high-energy explosives. We're talking about residue of such found in the World Trade Center dust, which was laid like a blanket, 4 inches thick, almost river to river, in lower Manhattan. And so we're talking about small red-gray chips that a team of scientists found, led by Niels Harrit in Copenhagen. This is very well documented in a 24-page peer-reviewed paper. And so in our DVD, which is called 9/11 Explosive Evidence, Experts Speak Out, which is on our website, which is ae911truth.org, we highlight that a real criminal investigation to find these perpetrators would follow the money, would look for who benefited.
So that is the strategy then to get a criminal investigation to ascertain the perpetrators?
Well, I think the first step is to awaken the Canadian and the American people and people all around the world to the reality that we were lied to by members of our government, by the media, and if we're looking for perpetrators, we should also look for those who had the capability to cover up the crime. This is an incredible crime. It's the crime of the century that has been deceitfully presented and covered up and perpetrated, and the motive of which appears to have been, I mean, this is pretty obvious, what happened after 9/11. Two countries were invaded. We're talking about oil in Iraq. That's pretty obvious to most people. After all, we're not talking about weapons of mass destruction, which were never found, or ties between Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein, which were never shown to have existed, or even Osama bin Laden's capture in Afghanistan, which by most accounts was fraudulent. The most recent capturing or kill. We need to look at people's research who have documented the rapid escalation of the opium production in Afghanistan under the U.S. watch.
The implications of your research and everything you've just told me suggest that we're talking about people at very, very high levels. I'm wondering if the authorities that could bring about a criminal investigation, have an independent investigation, are so compromised themselves that they'll do everything they can to prevent these things from happening. How do you challenge that?
Well, we challenge that by not pleading to the authorities to investigate their own. What we do is we educate the American and Canadian people in a $500,000 ad campaign in the month of September and October, which is what we've done with ads, billboards in 12 cities around the world, including Ottawa and Toronto, with taxi tops on taxis in those cities, posters in trains and buses, as we're doing in Ottawa in December and in Toronto in January. We have a huge grassroots effort to fund these programs and to educate people. When enough people become aware, officials will be forced to respond. This is indeed the only reason we got.
How will they be forced? How will they be forced?
Public pressure is the only thing that brings public officials to accountability. And this is the only reason we got a 9/11 commission in the first place, because the family members who started the 9/11 truth movement put so much pressure on the administration at the time, Bush administration, that after a year of avoiding any kind of public commission, were forced into having it by the specifically led by the Jersey Girls, as outlined in the movie 9/11 Press for Truth.
We're having this conversation during the month, which is the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination, and we've seen a tremendous amount of literature. There was even a major big blockbuster movie on JFK and the problems with that official story. And you know, when it comes to public awareness campaign, it doesn't get much bigger than that. And we don't seem to have seen that kind of pressure placed on the officials to have a criminal investigation, to re-invoke another investigation since the Warren Commission was clearly bankrupt. So, I mean, given that precedent, why would 9/11 be different?
Well, it is indeed an uphill battle, and you're citing the evidence on that side of the equation. What we see in the streets as we're handing out literature and DVDs and talking to people is about, these days, about half the people are actually aware that there's a problem or have suspicions. Maybe a quarter of the people can actually tell you some of the evidence. So this is very different from 5 years ago, say, when most people in the street would get quite angry, hostile, were in complete denial about the possibility that we might have been lied to about the destruction of these three buildings and the crimes of 9/11. So I think it's like watching a swimming pool. If you just watch it, it doesn't look like there's much progress. But over time, over years, it does indeed, in this case, with 9/11 awareness, fill up. The public subconscious is becoming aware. And at some point here, there will be a trigger event when we expect, anticipate that there will be people in the streets and mass numbers of Congress and senators being thrown out of office for their participation in the cover-up of 9/11 and just the denial or just the denial of it on their part. We don't know what level this conspiracy, if you will, rises. What we do know is that people are complicit by their silence, and that will not be tolerated after a mass awakening.
Okay. Well, certainly, I mean, as you know, Global Research does support the Rethink 911 campaign, and I'm not so sure about a criminal investigation or an independent investigation, but certainly if it causes one American to rethink its support for this project of war and continued civil liberties erosion, it'll probably have been worth it. So, Richard Gage, I think we're out of time now, but I want to thank you very much for explaining the campaign to us, and good luck with your ambitions.
Thank you, Michael. I appreciate it very much.
And we've been speaking with Richard Gage, who is the founder, Richard Gage AIA, founder of Architects and Engineers of 9/11 Truth, and the one of the organizers of the Rethink 911 campaign. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. 9/11 appears to be what's referred to as a state crime against democracy, and it points to the nature of power in the United States and what author and academic Peter Dale Scott refers to as deep politics. As discussed on our last program, state crimes against democracy encompass a number of events, including Iran-Contra, CIA facilitation of the drug trade, and perhaps most notably for some researchers, the assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and the Kennedy brothers, with the recent 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination having finally been breached. We'd like to use that anniversary to talk about how the powerful can get away with high crimes and what activists can learn from them to recalibrate their efforts at justice and reconciliation. I can think of no higher authority to turn to for these answers than Michael C. Rupert. Mike Rupert graduated with honors from UCLA in political science. He's a former LAPD narcotics officer who discovered the CIA trafficking drugs in 1977. After trying to expose that crime, he was forced out of the department in spite of earning the highest rating reports possible with no pending disciplinary actions. He comes from a family with an intelligence background and discovered he himself was being groomed to be an intelligence operative. He became an investigative journalist and was the publisher of the now defunct newsletter From the Wilderness, which broke stories on 9/11, drug money financing of the U.S. economy, peak oil, and the shooting death of Pat Tillman. In 2004, he authored Crossing the Rubicon, Decline of the American Empire at the End of the Age of Oil, which became one of the best-selling books on the subject of 9/11 from a perspective critical of the official story, and was later admitted to the Harvard Business School's prestigious Baker Library. He's appeared in numerous documentary films, including The End of Suburbia, and was profiled in the Chris Smith film Collapse, which premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in September 2009 to rave reviews. He was president of the Collapse Network until May of last year, and he currently resides in Colorado and hosts the Lifeboat Hour Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. So, Mike Rupert, welcome to the Global Research News Hour.
Well, that was a great intro. Thank you very much. It's good to be with you guys. Global Research has been a linchpin, a bedrock for a long time now, and I'm very grateful for the work you guys do.
Well, thank you very much. I wanted to bring up, because currently there's been a lot of energy devoted, especially over the last couple of months, something called the Rethink 9/11 campaign, being championed currently by architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. And they've been very much focused on one detail having to do with the collapse of World Trade Center 7, the idea that this one element sort of it's that major sticking point that really contradicts the official story coming out of the official investigations, and the thought being that somehow this is going to derail not just the official story but everything that's sprung from it. And I know that you have been long critical of the approach of focusing on the physical evidence, however compelling it may be, in terms of making a meaningful change in the political landscape. Is it possible you could explain why something like just focusing on the collapse of World Trade Center 7 would be problematic from the standpoint of trying to get a change in the current state of affairs?
Well, it is totally obvious that, and it has been from day one, and I've never said anything else, that the collapse of WTC-7 is not in any way, shape, or form explained by any of the events. Clearly, that was an extraneous event to the collisions of the two airliners into the World Trade Center. But proving, if you will, which is prima facie evident, that WTC-7 was not brought down by an aircraft impact does not prove who did it or why. I approached all of my work on around September the 11th from the standpoint of being a police detective, needing, wanting, knowing that in order to be successful, I would have to prepare a case that would be legally admissible in court, demonstrating, because it was obviously a case of multiple murder, you would have to demonstrate means, motive, and opportunity. And just saying that WTC-7 did not fall as a result of an airplane does not satisfy any of the requirements for a legal prosecution of those who perpetrated the attacks, which is the United States government under the control of Richard Cheney. With respect to the earlier physical evidence right after 9/11 from the World Trade Center, we saw that the debris from the World Trade Center was shipped off to China, to India. The chain of custody, a very important legal term, of the physical evidence was broken. There was no way to prove, and it was a Sisyphean task to assume that one could work back from pieces of rubble to determine who did it, why they did it, and how they arranged the opportunity and executed the crime. And we look down at the road now, all of these years later, and we see that I was absolutely correct. Nothing has ever happened. Now, as I compare that to the JFK assassination, there are, I'm sure, still groups that meet 50 years after the fact and talk about the physical evidence, the tape recordings, the bullets, all of the obvious flaws in the Warren Commission report and what the official story was. And it's just glaringly obvious that no change has been brought about because of it. And there is, as there is with any crime, a window of opportunity to solve the crime that closes as time passes. And I walked away from the 9/11 Truth Movement in late 2004, after the 2004 presidential election, when I realized that the opportunity or the will, the political will, and this is to the heart of everything that we're talking about, to address 9/11 did not exist and it would never be mustered. And that is still true today. We look at the abject criminality of in totality of the United States government, extra-constitutional behavior, total criminality, and it is absolutely patently ludicrous to expect that out of this somewhere, some court with jurisdiction and the will is going to arise to pursue September the 11th. They got away with it. That's the bottom line.
Mm. Well, here in Canada, in the city of Ottawa, there was what's being hailed by some within the movement as a breakthrough, in the sense that there was controversy over this advertising campaign on buses saying did you know a third tower fell, and there was a lot of uproar saying, well, this is an insult to the 9/11 families, and so it came to city council as part of a move to change the advertising policies on the buses, and that was an opportunity where in a city council meeting, the committee meeting, the people within the 9/11 Truth Movement, who were speaking in a very professional and very technical terms, were able to explain why it's not appropriate to want to ban this kind of advertising from buses. But I guess you would still say that this isn't going to go anywhere.
It's a side issue. It's irrelevant. Okay. The only thing that matters is changing the political landscape. And nothing, absolutely nothing is going to come of 9/11 now. Nobody's going to ever get it reopened. And given the fact that we are facing near-term human extinction from climate collapse, abundantly well documented by scores of peer-reviewed studies, that we have potentially been exposed to life-terminating amounts of radiation from Fukushima, which is still out of control, there are much higher priorities involved, which have to do with staying alive. So I can't entertain that. But as I look back to John Kennedy, there were so many flaws, apparent, obvious, pointed out by the pioneers like Mark Lane and Peter Dale Scott and so many others, that what was apparent was that the people never, ever, ever mustered or possessed or exercised the will to tear down the whole government. And the fact remains, is that to solve any of these criminal cases, it is going to be absolutely necessary to tear down everything that we know as government now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no time to do that. There's no resources. We're in the middle of the collapse of human industrial civilization.
Okay. In your book, Crossing the Rubicon, in the introduction, I'm just going to read a quote from it. I had studied how the investigation into the murder of President John F. Kennedy had been controlled. I had also personally painful and verifiable knowledge that the murder of John's brother Robert was a CIA operation. All the goodwill and energy of the researcher activists in each of these cases was deliberately and meticulously sabotaged by interested parties and their allies in the dominant political class. Mike, is it possible for you to just sort of help spell out that the nature of that sabotage, the pattern that you saw with the Kennedy brothers and what we've seen today with 9/11?
We're also seeing it with Fukushima.
Mm.
And we're also seeing it with climate collapse. This is the same machine that has always been there and available and had available to it enormous amounts of resources, a tsunami of resources to throw at a disinformation campaign to muddy the waters and confuse people's perception, the purpose of which was to overwhelm, drown out in noise the people who were carrying the real message. For example, me. We have seen the rise of clear and extremely well-documented disinformation artists from Alex Jones to many others who have enormous amounts of money and resources to muddy and confuse the waters. If you go back to the 60s and the 70s, the government program called COINTELPRO, which was directed ruthlessly at the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement. It is has been abundantly documented. War Churchill, who I've met, did a great book on it. That the government, if you will, these are people who will be doing what they do. Don't pin it on one agency. It is a paradigm within every agency, but they will send infiltrators into campaigns to sow disinformation, to create discord and harmony, to sabotage operations, to muddy the message, to insert poison pills specifically. Peter Dale Scott was a mentor for many years, and he had a great line. Disinformation, in order to be effective, must be 90% accurate. People will eat a little tab of poison if it's wrapped in a beautiful, sweet, sticky cinnamon bun. But that poison will kill them nonetheless. And that has been the chief tactic used for many years. That's why I have so separated and isolated, put in quarantine, if you will, my own life's body of work so that it would not be contaminated by the enormous amounts of disinformation that have been sown not only into 9/11 and JFK and Bobby and Martin and everything else. That's the way it continues to work now.
Hmm. Yeah. Could you give us a little bit more? I mean, you've mentioned about the disinformation aspect of it, and mainstream media has. I mean, we've seen just over the last week with the 9/11, the JFK anniversary, how the official story is, even in spite of the release of the film JFK, which I think got at a lot of the critical messaging.
Great film. That was a watershed moment. Yeah.
Yeah. And even with that, there does not seem to be, as you're saying, a mustering of the political will to do anything about it. Could you, help us understand, like, how is it that mainstream media, in spite of all of this, comes through the internet or that movie, blockbuster movies like JFK, that they can still manage to not only ignore but reinforce that official story?
You are in asking the question. You disclose that you are a prisoner of an erroneous assumption, which I am not. your assumption being that the mainstream media has motive, incentive, and/or a desire to tell the truth. They don't. They are owned by corporations. Corporations are the ruling, governing paradigm. Corporations and banks, the infinite growth paradigm on this planet. The sole purpose of mainstream media has been to reinforce the meme of infinite growth, which is no longer possible, of all of the evils that we see taking place right now. If you take a step back from that and understand completely that mainstream media's purpose has always been the control of what people think, then the question becomes completely different. They cannot tell the truth, because to tell the truth invalidates their own existence.
Mm-hmm. So when you have an intrepid reporter, say somebody like Gary Webb, who is in the business of trying to expose these lies, the mainstream media will find ways of cutting them down, throwing them out of the matrix, so to speak.
Gary was a very, very dear friend of mine, and I owe more to Gary Webb than probably any other two or three people in the history of my life, and I miss him dearly. Although I'm glad he's not here to see what's happening now. You have an intrepid reporter, but the intrepid reporter has no control of what goes on a corporate news site page. He has editors. He has publishers. There are rules. Intrepid reporters get shut down. It is childish naivete to believe that one intrepid reporter for, let's say, the New York Times or somebody else can actually go out and tell the truth when the historical landscape is littered with the corpses of intrepid reporters who lost their careers and their jobs. They were cast aside because there was always more cannon fodder to fill their shoes.
Hmm.
Who would be compliant?
We are looking at, there's basically a huge gap between the reality of government and media and what we're really dealing with. We have this sort of veneer of democracy, basically disguising a very different machine, which essentially exists to protect and reinforce that whole, as you say, infinite growth paradigm, profit making unto infinity. Even with the efforts by independent journalists like yourself and independent websites like Global Research, I mean, do you see any hope of basically just increasing that, raising that awareness, getting the stories out in a way that will ultimately derail and decouple and disseminate that whole structure of malignant?
It's too late. We've passed all the available opportunities to muster the will to do this. I would call it a liberal pseudo-progressive approach of incremental changes, and maybe someday we'll get to a place where we can deal with the truth. It has been, in effect, very naive and I would say at some point cowardly, because the human race never mustered the will to address these situations, which people like me and many others, but you know, I'll speak of the 35, 36 years of my career, have been saying, unless you deal with these problems early on, the ones that we spent our lives pointing out, we are going to wind up here. Well, we're already here. We're at the end of the road. Mainstream media is rapidly losing its market share. Well, okay, that's good, but it's too little, too late. CNN's numbers have dropped off to nothing, and as you guys know, and a lot of other intrepid websites know, your market share is increasing, your reach is increasing, but it's too little, too late.
Hmm. Okay. Now, I remember a famous analogy of yours from long ago. I mean, shortly after you kind of dropped out of the 9/11 activism, you talked about an analogy of that herd of stampeding elephants. Mm-hmm. JFK and 9/11, the elephants that have run us over. I mean, we have more elephants running towards us, and I'm wondering if you maybe would just like to focus now here, as it is the 50th anniversary of the JFK assassination. What are those elephants? Could you identify for them those elephants we most need to be concerned about right now?
I stand firmly with my friends and colleagues like Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus from the University of Arizona, Carolyn Baker, and a great many people out here. It is obvious that there are two issues. And they appear to be catch-22 issues. They are climate collapse and Fukushima subhead, all 450 rapidly deteriorating nuclear power plants around the world, plus waste storage facilities that are leaking, both of which are life-threatening events for all life on the planet. It's a mathematical certainty that a 5, 6, maybe 7 degree centigrade increase in global temperatures, never seen on this planet in the last several million years, are absolute certainties. 25 positive feedback loops have been triggered. Arctic methane release from the tundra, methane clathrate, hydrate release from the seas, the diminishing albedo effect, reflectivity as the polar ice disappears, 25 positive, and we're close to a major tipping point where Mother Earth may be about to burp 10 gigatons or 10 teratons of carbon directly into the atmosphere, which is more carbon than has ever been released in all of mankind's human industrial activity from the baseline of the late 1700s. That's near-term human extinction by 2030, mathematical certainty. There is nothing more important than that. But by the same token, we are now living in an increasing body of evidence, and I'm very active with this on Facebook right now and in my own radio show, that at Fukushima we have been lied to. Gee, what a surprise. That we have had 3 core meltdowns and 4 spent fuel pools have already been completely combusted. Helen Caldicott, a guest on my show, said that just as the spent fuel pool above number 4, which we now are very certain has already been combusted, TEPCO is lying, contained the equivalent of 10 Chernobyls. All the spent fuel pools at Fukushima contain the equivalent of 85 Chernobyls, and that's not including the radioactive waste that's being incinerated, the amount of radioactivity being dumped into the Pacific Ocean. These are life-terminating amounts of radiation for the entire planet. So there are no more important issues than that. I mean, I was trained as a police officer, and I spent many years in the company of U.S. Army Special Forces and Navy SEALs throughout my investigative career, and it's very obvious that when you are confronted with life-threatening situations, you deal with what's threatening your life first. There is nothing else to discuss until after those are addressed.
I'm wondering, in the event that we can get Arne Gunderson or some other expert on the phone, hopefully for next week, well, what do you think are the key questions that need to be put to them about the situation in Fukushima right now?
What is the exact status of spent fuel pool 4 in a way that corresponds to NRC transcripts that have been released and obtained under the Freedom of Information Act? Where is spent fuel pool 3, since there are no floors above the containment vessel? Arne Gunderson probably will not come on. I wish he would. But there are an internet journalist named Patrick Penry, who I find to be enormously credible because he works exactly the same way I always have, using documents and forensically analyzing and presenting actual U.S. government documents and transcripts. Has the NRC documents that have been released show absolutely that 3 cores have melted down and 4 spent fuel pools most likely are gone, at least 3. Are gone in complete contradiction to the official story right now. We have been lied to, and I have deep respect for Arne Gunderson, but he needs to clarify his position on that, because the actions of TEPCO in trying to remove, or saying that they're trying to remove, that's a dog and pony show. It's a circus. It is a charade, which is absolutely insulting to any kind of investigative journalistic intelligence. There is no way to deny our way out of this. That radiation's already out of the barn.
Mm. Well, rather a daunting development.
It's all on my Facebook page, but I strongly recommend people search for Hatrick Penry, because there you can, and my Facebook page for several days now has been just loaded with pages and pages of documents released by the U.S. government with a court reporter stamp on it involving NRC Chairman Jasko, the whole team reporting to the White House, and the transcripts tell a completely different story than what mainstream or a good portion of, I would say, the co-opted or hoodwinked alternative press is putting out. The evidence is overwhelming.
Okay, Mike, we're just about at the end of our time. Do you have a last message, maybe a last desperate message to those of us in the mainstream media who are concerned to tell the truth, as brutal and unpleasant as it might be? Anything you'd like to leave with us?
Yeah, I am firmly sitting in a comfortable space with my friends Guy McPherson, Carolyn Baker, and a great many others, acknowledging that the human race is in hospice. We are dying. Our fate is, from a 3D Cartesian standpoint, it is secured. The only messages of light that are coming now are from indigenous peoples all over the world, like Chief Avril Looking Horse, Chief Oren Lyons, but not just in North America, but also from South America. These are the people who have kept and maintained against all persecutions for thousands of years the rules of life. And the only thing left for the human race now, and I encourage people to, Chief Looking Horse made a statement to the UN recently, that the indigenous peoples open the way to a consciousness, which is the only hope left for us. But I follow Native American spirituality. It is a good day to die, and it is time to die, to prepare ourselves to die well, to live well, to love, to be the best us people that we can possibly be. And in that, there will be meaning in what comes and what follows.
Mike Rupert, it's been an immense pleasure speaking with you on this historically significant month. Thank you very much for your perspectives and for your input. And hope to hear from you again.
We hope to hear from everybody again.
We've been speaking with Michael Rupert, author of Crossing the Rubicon, investigative journalist, and current host of the Lifeboat Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. And that marks the end of our show for this week. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.